This week, we welcome Henry Harrison, Chief Technology Officer at Garrison, to discuss how hardware security solutions from the intelligence community can help with the commercial industry. In the leadership and communications section, balancing the company's needs and employee satisfaction, technology that will actually make you more productive, four principles for security metrics, and more. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Weekly. Do you know what the biggest cyber risk is for your organization? It's the browser, and your users are in it all the time. Every time a link is clicked, untrusted web code enters your network and runs on your machine, exposing you to risk. What if users had full access to the web but never touched web code? You'd have all the benefit of the web and none of the risk. That's why Authenticate built Silo. It's a browser built in the cloud that runs all web content in a remote, isolated browser that never touches your network or device. With a simple click, your organization is fully protected from all web exploits. Find out more at securityweekly.com/authenticate. That's authentic number 8. The question is simple. Have any of the systems on my network been compromised? The answer is harder than it should be. Enter AI Hunter. Active Countermeasures has automated and streamlined techniques used by the best pen testers and threat hunters in the industry to create AI Hunter, a network threat hunting solution that does the first pass of a hunt for you to identify systems that are most likely to be compromised and scores the results on a scale from 0 to 100. You can then research those systems in depth with AI Hunter. Focus your valuable time on the systems that need your expertise with AI Hunter. Sign up for a personal demo today at securityweekly.com/ACM. Let the team at Black Hills Information Security test your defenses. With over 10 years of experience in penetration testing, red teaming, and threat hunting, the testers at Black Hills will help you find the holes in your security before the bad guys do. The team at Black Hills cares about educating and sharing their knowledge by creating countless blogs, open source tools, and webcasts for you to learn more about the tradecraft of pen testing and red teaming. Visit securityweekly.com/BHIS to join their mailing list and view the latest blogs and webcasts from Black Hills Information Security.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 150, recorded November 4th, 2019. I am your host, Matt Alderman, here in Colorado. Joining me from G-Unit Studio in Rhode Island are my co-hosts, Paul Asadorian and Jason Albuquerque.
Hey, Matt. Good to be here.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Good. Happy Monday.
Welcome
back, Jason.
Not as good a Monday as we're used to having,
no,
but you know.
No.
I know. We won't talk about it.
No, we can talk,
about it. The Ravens were a great team last night.
Yeah, they were.
I mean, you know,
we needed that. It's very humbling. Mm-hmm. It's good.
It is. I was when I saw the score, I'm like, really? So yeah, I didn't watch it, but yeah, definitely something miraculous happened on the Ravens side last night.
Yeah, their quarterback.
Yep. We weren't.
The new Security Weekly website is officially live. Visit securityweekly.com to check out all of our new sorting and filtering functionality. Please let us know if you find any issues, like the 2404s that Joe just found, or have any feedback by sending an email to website@securityweekly.net. I will fix them right after the show, don't worry. By the time you see this, they will be fixed. Henry Harrison is a seasoned technology industry executive and serial entrepreneur who spent the last 10 years focused on cybersecurity, both as an independent consultant and as a technical director for cybersecurity at UK defense and security company BAE Systems. Henry's previous ventures include a desktop video conferencing startup and has been responsible for developing and selling advanced electronic solutions into governments, telecommunications companies, and financial services organizations, among others. Henry, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So first of all, I love the accent, so we're just going to let you talk a lot.
Well, that should do it, right? That's all you need from me.
Exactly right. But actually, let's go through a little history, right?
I mean, sure.
This segment, we're going to talk about some of the lessons learned out of the intelligence community to be applied to the commercial side from a security perspective. But let's get a little background in where some of this knowledge comes from.
Well, I tell you what, I'm going to go back almost exactly 10 years ago. And just at that time, I worked for a company with a lot of background in the national security space, and it got acquired by this big defense company, BAE Systems. And actually, what they asked us to do was go out and build them a cybersecurity business. And we had built some really cool stuff based around behavioral analytics, kind of building into a security operations center business and so on. And you know, this is only 10 years ago. We used to go around and see business leaders and say, this is what we're doing. And the response we used to get was, hey, it's very cool the stuff you guys are doing, but this is really for three-letter agencies only. I mean, why are you telling me this stuff? I'm a business person. I'm not a spy. And 10 years later, right, we have behavioral analytics in every network. Everybody's got a SOC. Everybody's got threat intelligence and so on. So this has form, right? These techniques that start out in the national security sector have a tendency to make their way ultimately into the mainstream commercial world. And it's kind of no surprise, really, because if you go like 20 years ago. Then you had national security organizations who faced cyber threats from other national security organizations. But if you're a commercial organization 20 years ago, you faced threats from kids in their bedrooms. And that kind of threat landscape kind of converged over the last couple of decades. And now, the same attackers are attacking everybody. So it's no surprise, really, that some of the techniques that we see are starting to converge across those two markets.
And so in our national intelligence communities, right, they see these advanced threats way before most of the commercials. Financials maybe see some of this earlier than most of the other industries.
I think these days that's right, but I mean, it wasn't the case even 10 years ago, right? Because like financials just weren't seeing this stuff. But nowadays, I probably spend about 50% of my time with governments and about 50% of my time with financial services. That tends to be the two sectors that I spend most of my time with. And the what we're hearing from some of the financial services customers is that the sophistication of some of the attacks that they're seeing is now, it's really approaching the same levels that are being seen in that kind of nation state. Arena. So that gap has already closed very, very dramatically. And not, I think, every financial, definitely not the case that every financial service organization has really woken up to that. I was in a conversation the other day with two of the seniors at one of the world's largest banks, and one of them was kind of essentially saying, well, it's not really fair that we have to defend against this kind of stuff. And it's like, well, yeah, you're right. It's not really fair, but it's just the way, unfortunately, the world is now.
Yeah, yeah, it's really funny. I saw this meme, and it was like hackers in the late 90s action movies, right? And it's this kid on a bus with the hat, like a cap and glasses and the anarchy sign on his t-shirt, right? And he's like chuckling. He's like, I'm in, right? Like that's how those were the threats we used to have to defend against.
Exactly. Yeah. And now you've got this, the world's just woken up to this whole thing the other thing that we used to get as a response 10 years ago when we were going around to see people, we'd go and see kind of business leaders and they would say, cybersecurity. Yeah. I think there's a guy called Bob in IT who deals with that. and now, it's like we spend quite a lot of time at the moment at the World Economic Forum. Mm-hmm. Their last kind of risk report had, I think, cybersecurity risk at something like number 3 or something. So business leaders all over the world now, they know that cybersecurity is something that affects them, and it's definitely no longer the preserve of Bob in IT, right?
It's funny, we've been talking about the progression, and I forget which interview, it might have been the folks from Qualys, we were talking about the progression of the security professional, right? Mm-hmm. And 10 plus years ago, and even still today, a lot of us in security are still the folks in the trenches because there's no one else, right? You're that guy, Bob, in IT. You're responsible for security. Yeah. That means operationally, you're also doing security stuff and security research and threat modeling, right? Where I think it's going is that you're guiding the rest of IT when it comes to security. I really think that's the progression, that your technical outlets are more doing research, right?
Yeah.
Reverse engineering malware and studying threats and testing stuff in the lab, and a lot less operational. That's the place where I think we have to be.
It is, in order to achieve
security.
And it's not just guiding IT; it's guiding the rest of the business.
Guiding the business,
right? Guiding the business because you want your board of directors to make intelligent decisions with investments. Mm-hmm. You want your leadership to be making intelligent strategic decisions for the company, and you want your peers, if you have a seat at the table as a CISO, to be able to make those collaborative decisions with you. To make sure that you're securing the entire business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing that would be interesting. I heard you've got a role that now involves CIO as well as CISO or something. But the what we've seen over the last decade is a lot of the security focus was on overlay. It was stuff that you could do independently of the business. But, you know, and that's made a huge difference. But now a lot of what we see people needing to do is stuff that actually requires IT to do things differently.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right? So it's no longer something the CISO can just deliver on their own.
Exactly.
It needs to be IT actually delivers that. So I think we'll see more and more of that kind of convergence of the roles and the need to guide the operations of the rest of the business.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. Do you see it going from a security operations center to just the operations center, and there's a security component to everything we do?
I think it has to be baked into the DNA of the business, right? Mm-hmm. So I honestly do, right? So for us, we're a technology services company. We have to be ingrained into the DNA of our implementation teams, our network operations center, right? Security operations center, HR. They're designing policies that if the InfoSec folks don't have influence on, it could be a policy that could, you know, have an adverse effect on the business. Same thing with finance, right? If we don't have a seat at the table with the CFO and we're not helping make decisions for the business and being an influencer there, we could have some bad practices or processes within our finance department.
Yeah, I mean, so the way that we tend to look at it from is that you spent 10 years kind of, so 10 years ago, people were going, okay, well, this is, you know, why are you telling me this stuff? This is not relevant to my business. Then you get, okay, the business got the idea. So now we have to put in place we really have to focus on the monitor and respond, the detect and respond parts of the NIST framework, right? So that's really been huge focus over the last decade. And now we've got to turn around and say, okay, well, is this really as good as it gets, or can we actually do stuff to protect ourselves better in the first place? And there are certainly folks out there who just go, yeah, this is as good as it gets. It's when, not if. There's nothing to be done about cybersecurity. All we can do is you know, run operations, detect and respond when we get breached. And I've always felt that's just a council of despair. You've got to say, well, actually, what can we do to make it harder for the bad guys? You know, what can we do to make it more difficult to get into this environment? And that's certainly the space. You know, if you look from a nation state perspective, citizens are not going to be very enamored of their national security organizations if they just turn around and say, well, you know what, there's nothing we can do, the bad guy, you know, our enemies are always going to get into our systems, that's just the way it is.
Agreed.
And I don't think it's really tenable in the commercial space long term either. Yeah.
So Henry, true. what are some of the things that you can apply from your background working with nation state agencies that can transcend into the enterprise? And I completely agree. I think we see a lot of enterprises, we kind of have that mindset of like, yeah, attackers are going to get in and we'll detect and respond. And I agree, we need to get on that protection front. But knowing all the hackers that we do, we know what a challenging task that
is. It's really hard, right? So if you go back, again, you know, decades ago, then how did the kind of national security world organize itself? Well, it basically said, we basically do isolation. That's been their approach. And we don't really trust any technology to keep us safe. So we just have completely isolated networks, and we trust air, right? So we keep them separated, and they're separated by air. And frankly, there's not a lot of lesson to be learned in that for the commercial world, because it's completely impractical. Yeah. You certainly don't want to be the guy who goes to the CEO and says, right, well, the answer to our cybersecurity is everybody's going to get multiple laptops, right?
Yeah.
That's the answer. And you'll be out the door pretty quick. Mm. Although, that said, we have a banking customer, actually, which literally did that. That was the strategy they set off down. They were like, okay, our global payments group is such a big issue for us that we are going to cut off internet access, and we're going to start distributing a second laptop to everybody in that group so that they can access the internet And I think they got up into double figures with that before it was clear this is not a sustainable strategy. Right. Mm-hmm. So that kind of approach isn't. But if you think about those worlds that were historically as isolated and air-gapped as that, that's not really a sustainable strategy for them any longer, right? Because they live in a networked world. They've got to operate in the internet. They need to take advantage of all the fish. So they've really been focusing on, well, how can we overcome the inefficiency and the business disabling that comes through isolating everything as strongly as we used to? And how can we do that without introducing all the security risks that the commercial world's got, right? Because that's obviously a non-starter as well. So quietly in the background, you've seen, and I think, you know, in the UK, we've been particularly leading this field. You've seen some really strong innovation coming out of that national security sector about how to build those kinds of solutions that allow you to join very sensitive environments to very risky environments, right? So like, how do you, well, what my business does, for example, but there's other stuff as well, is like, how do you give people working on a very, very sensitive system the ability to browse to www.verydangeroussite.com in such a way that they can just click on a link, but you don't have to worry about the fact there might be malware at the other end of that link. And so that kind of stuff is really going on. And the question is, how do you build those kinds of systems that really can give you that level of trust that you would do that? And if you can build those kinds of systems, why would that not be the sort of thing you'd want to do in the commercial world as well? And the real insight that's unlocked a whole new field really there is the insight that you really can't practically deliver that by just by writing software. You have to revisit things at the hardware level. And that might not seem like much of an insight, right? Because you can't go building brand new hardware systems for everything you want to do. But the final piece of the puzzle that made it all possible was to start using a different type of silicon, as a type of silicon called a field programmable gate array, an FPGA, which is kind of, for those who don't know it, and obviously it's kind of been a tool of electronic engineers for many years, but for those who don't know it, it's essentially programmable digital logic. So you kind of, it's kind of like allows you to get a halfway house between hardware and software. So it can be programmable, so you can change what it does, but once you've set it to do something, then until you reprogram it, it only does that thing.
And it does that thing really fast, right?
Well, so historically, that's why people have liked using FPGAs, because you simplify things down and then they go really, really fast.
Right.
And I've done quite a lot of that in my past as well. We did some pretty good high-speed systems using FPGAs.
Right, yeah, wireless researchers were using them back in the day.
It's a big business, right? So there's like, I think it's a $5 billion a year business in FPGAs. So a lot of telecoms kit has FPGAs in. There's a lot used in, as you say, in wireless spaces and so on. So it's hardly a new thing. It's a tried and tested thing. But there's a kind of computer science type insight here, which is that if you, the real reason that software is so vulnerable is because, you know, a computer is a universal Turing machine. Right, it can do anything you want it to. Just give it the right software, and it'll do anything you want it to. And if you're an attacker, that means that you find a clever way of doing something. It'll do exactly what you want it to as well. But if you use simpler computational models that you can implement using FPGA silicon, then you really just massively reduce the scope for an attacker, because the thing's been programmed to do this thing, and that's the scope of what they can achieve is limited by what the thing has been configured to do. It's not a universal computing device. It will do that thing. And that is really exciting, because it allows us to start building security controls that we can really have some strong level of confidence in. And at that point, you can really start to say, well, actually, I'm going to build some systems that allow me to connect very risky things and very sensitive things together in such a way that I really trust the security controls that are being implemented in between. So I know there's some of the terminology that we're using there around FPGAs and Turing machines and so on is not day-to-day conversation in the security space. But I think that's what gets me excited, is that this is a really new frontier for how to do security.
And Henry, are these primarily these types of hardware security components? Are they primarily at the networking and endpoint layer? Is that traditionally where these types of techniques can be applied?
Well, I guess there's all sorts of ways you might do it architecturally. There's a lot of stuff's been done at the network layer historically. There's no reason things can't be done at the endpoint layer as well, but I think endpoint changes are harder gig from a security perspective. You know, we started off down this room. We said, shall we try and build a really great laptop that allows you to click on links? Or shall we try and build some network equipment that allows you to click on links? And the reality is that to go to a big enterprise and persuade them to go and change all their laptops is not a very good business model. But to go and say, well, you can install this equipment in the network and then you can do it, or you can use this as a cloud service, that's a more of a practical proposition for organizations. So I think that's typically where it's being done today. But I think I do actually think you know, that in the long term, the opportunity to take some of these ideas and build them into the endpoints is also going to be a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, we've always thought about aspects of our security programs kind of external to the network or the endpoint, right? We've always kind of wrapped solutions around, right? We deployed firewalls to protect the internal network from the internet, and that didn't get us very far. So, you know, rethinking the problem a little bit is interesting. The question is, with cloud and some of the other technology trends that are going on, how much control do you have of some of that network traffic? Is it something you have to control at your side and the cloud providers have to do it? Are there ways
to
do that?
Yeah, I think the danger here, right, is that you end up seeing this as being a mapping purely onto a traditional perimeter model. And, you know, for a lot of government type customers, that is still very much where they are. They still have, you know, physical infrastructure defining this stuff. But there's no reason in the long term why this can't be consistent with a you know, zero trust kind of beyond corp cloud model as well. Because the real question is not necessarily about networks in the sense of, you know, that might be practically where you deploy some of the kit. But really what we're starting to talk about is the sort of segmentation which people are talking about in any way in the context of zero trust, for example, or beyond corp. And it's really about taking that segmentation and really thinking about trust in the context of those segmentations, and not just segmenting for the sake of segmentation, but thinking about, okay, well, what's the different trust environment I've got in this segment or in this segment, and incorporating the endpoint into that. Because I think there's a lot of security architecture that people are looking at the moment involving segmentation, but you've still got the fact that the endpoint has to be able to do whatever the user needs to be able to do, and that user is not going to have multiple laptops, right? And that me or multiple phones, or they're going to have they want a human interface device that gives them access to all the stuff they need, and they need some really risky stuff like www.goodnessknowswhat.com, and they also need some really sensitive stuff like, hello, here's my customer database, or hello, here's, in the case of my banking customer, here's my global payments interface to the Swift payment system. And it's really about how you kind of extend that segmentation through so that so that it runs all the way through the architecture, including through to the endpoint, where the endpoint can say, okay, well, if I'm going to access this risky stuff, I do it this way through this piece of equipment that's somewhere in the cloud, and if I'm accessing this sensitive piece of it, then I do it in a different way, so that ultimately I'm not presenting my endpoint as a potential pivot point between the risky and the sensitive. So that's kind of at the core of the architectural approach, I think.
But it still sounds like there's software involved, right? And anytime we've taken the same piece of hardware, I think that's why we had two separate pieces of hardware, right? Because we had that peace of mind that they were separate. Right. When they're one, it's still software that's applying those gates.
Well, not necessarily. I think that's it. So if we try and get right under the covers here, I think that there are two questions, right? There is a question, if you're going to go down a cloud architecture of encryption, right? Because if we're doing a cloud-based architecture, we've got to talk to remote systems. We assume that we're plugged into the internet, that the things are over the internet. Clearly, we've got to have crypto between our endpoints and those cloud-based systems. And today, that's reliant on software, right? There's no doubt about it. And definitely, there are, you know, if you go to the full-on government world, there are folks out there who say, you know, absolutely, I do not trust software for crypto. I've got to have hardware-based crypto. Mm-hmm. And And that will probably come in the commercial world, but it's probably not the biggest issue right now, right? Because the attack surface is relatively small. But the question is, once you get into the cloud, what are you getting to, and how does that give you access to information? So, for example, what we do is we have a piece of hardware that we produce that can sit in the cloud or it can sit in a data center, and essentially, it is a gateway to risky content. And the way that it does that is that it does some security, which in this case is essentially it turns the risky content into pixels, which is not unique to us. There are some other folks mm-hmm. that do it as well. But the key point is that the control over that is implemented in hardware so that you know mm-hmm. At the hardware level that the only thing it's delivering to you is pixels. Now, you could think about the encryption link between your endpoint and that device. And at that point, you could, you know, some of our government customers will say, I'm not going to trust software crypto as a way of getting between my endpoint and that device. I'm going to have to rely on hardware crypto, mm-hmm. and they can go buy that, not from me, but they can buy it from other folks. Overwhelmingly, the commercial world today takes the view that, you know, and frankly, I agree that software crypto is by no means the weakest link in the chain,
right?
That we're operating.
It's typically the user. And if you're making yeah. that user inherently more secure.
Well, it's the user's endpoint, right? I mean, because so the user, you can never stop people hacking people's brains, right? I mean, that's if you can come up with a solution to that, then you can not only can you solve cybersecurity, you can rule the world as well. Mm-hmm. But what you can try and do is stop people hacking the user's endpoint, because that's what happens, right? Is that the user does stupid stuff and it ends up with their endpoint being compromised, and then the endpoint has access to all the good stuff, and now it's a bad scene, right? So mm-hmm. try and focus on like what can you do to make sure that even if the user does a really bad thing, they still can't actually compromise their endpoint, and then now you're getting somewhere.
Yeah, you mean when the user does?
Yeah, when. Yeah, that's when, a much when. Better word mm-hmm. to use. Exactly, that's right. You can, and everybody runs training programs, and I'm not really saying they shouldn't run training programs to teach people to click links. But I think it was really interesting that when we founded our Garrison about 5 years ago, we came out of this big organization, and there were two of us, and then we got another couple of people, and we needed to hire some folks. So we got this lady who had worked with us at BAE Systems, who worked in human resources, to come and help us kind of set up a recruitment process. And she had been through mandatory anti-phishing training, right? I mean, I have no idea how many times she'd been through a mandatory anti-phishing training. And we were like taking her through an early prototype of our system. We said, if you just click on this URL, and she said, what is a URL? I just thought it was a good indication of how effective phishing training probably is for most people.
Yeah, we've had some of those conversations recently about how there is, while some technical level gets instilled upon the users, there's often a lot that's missing. And when you talk about awareness and training, there's limitations to each of them.
Right.
And with solutions like yours and others we've looked at, anything you can do to lessen how much awareness and or training you give your users and still have them be, air quotes, secure, is that those are the solutions we need today.
It's not only good for security, it's good for business as well, right?
Absolutely.
Because if you go and hire people, you don't hire them to be cybersecurity analysts. Well, I mean, obviously, if you hire cybersecurity analysts, you hire them to be cybersecurity analysts. But if you hire somebody to do a job in human resources, mm-hmm. you're not hiring them for their expertise in cybersecurity. You're hiring them for their expertise in human resources. And every minute that they spend doing training on cybersecurity is time that they're spending doing the thing that they're least efficient at rather than the thing they're most efficient at. Mm-hmm. So really, you know, the business objective surely has to be to optimize people to do the thing they're good at rather than to, have them spend all their time trying to do the thing they're really not good at.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say is how far can you take a hardware security approach to help that use case, right? I mean, some point, there's still a human in the mix that...
Yeah.
You know, yeah, but you do the wrong
so
thing.
You're right, right? I mean, so you know the XKCD cartoon, right? The you probably had like, every interview he's probably talked about this one. It's the one with the two panels, and on the left-hand side it says the geek stream, and it says, oh, his laptop's encrypted. We got to build $1 million supercomputer to crack the password. And on the right-hand side, the guy's saying, you know, the reality, he says, just hit him over the head with this $5 wrench until he tells us the password. And I kind of pin that up everywhere. So at the end of the day, it's people, right? So if they hit you over the head with a $5 wrench, you're going to give them the information. But the point is that you don't, you know, if you hit someone over the head with a $5 wrench, there's a risk you're going to get picked up by the cops. But right now, just hacking into their system exposes you to effectively zero risk, and it's just terrifically easy. So that's the way people go. So you can't solve everything. You can never take people out of the equation, but you can certainly make things a lot harder.
Yeah, and if you can shrink down the attack surface, that helps, because users probably, in general, open up a big attack surface. So anything you can do to minimize that helps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, for us, we started this business, we just figured the biggest attack surface is the web. I mean, you know, people open a web browser and they think, well, I click on a website, it's become, you know, but the number of things that happen behind the scenes when that actually takes place, right? It's like people that you've never met, that you know nothing about, send you vast amounts of, you know, all sorts of different types of content, and you have like a supercomputer sitting in front of you that churns through it all, that ends up displaying some image on the screen to you. It's an astonishingly complex thing with an incredibly large attack surface. And we just take that kind of thing for granted, but it's just fundamentally super dangerous.
Yeah, definitely.
So Henry, just a quick question. I mean, you know, as a CISO and a leader within my organization, I look at the concept of reducing the range of functions of the hardware, right? As a protective measure, but then I also look at it from the adverse side, and it says, now I'm not going to realize the economies of scale that I could get out of this computer system, right? So what does that do? Have you done any research on what that does as far as investments and cost and things of that nature?
Yeah, but I think that's the key. I think the key is not to try and do that, right? Because clearly we still need regular computers. this is what we do. I mean, if we're going to take advantage of artificial intelligence, we're going to take advantage of automation and so on, we need the incredible revolution that the central processing unit essentially has brought us over the last few decades. So we really mustn't get rid of that. The question is, how can we build a security architecture around that that says, well, you know, we're absolutely willing to take the risk because of the benefits that brings us, but we need to segment that, right? So that we say, okay, well, we've got this Ukrainian accounting system, and that's fine. We recognize the risk, but if it blows up, it better not take down the rest of our business. And so, how can we build controls around the segmentation that mean that we can contain things, and that we have confidence about what goes in and what goes out, and we can actually so it's a much more specific thing. And I think there's definitely a danger with this, because it's so new and so different that people hear what I'm saying and they go, oh my god, he's suggesting that we're going to throw away people's laptops and replace them with some chunk of tin that only plays Pong.
That would help security. Not so much usability, but
great from a security perspective. Yeah, I think we can all agree that's the future, right? Because that's. But
at the end of the day, as we learn more about this, that's going to be the initial perspective from a leader who has a budget, right? So I have a budget. Yeah. I have to invest in security. I have to make sure I'm strategically investing in security. So the first thing I'm going to think about is, how does that affect my budget? Is it going to cost more money for my organization?
We're having a good conversation here, and you should be aware, this is not how I run my sales meetings, right? We don't tend to talk about like, what problem can I solve for you? And typically the problem is like, how can I allow my users to click on dangerous links that are in phishing emails, for example, without worrying that they're going to bring down my network? Mm-hmm. So that's the practical day-to-day of what I happen to do and so on. I think, you know, but it's fun in these kind of environments to project forward kind of 10, 20 years. Well, what's information technology going to look like then? Because, you know, frankly, what we've got today is really not fit for purpose in the threat landscape that we're living in. So it's going to have to change pretty aggressively over the course of the next decade or two. Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of, interesting to imagine where we're going. And that's kind of the direction of travel that I see it heading down.
We're going to carry around a phone that has an HSM module in it that connects to all the different cloud services that have HSM modules in it. And it might be a brick, but we'll be a little more secure.
Yeah, I mean, that's why these things take a long time, right? And that's why I'm not sure the end point is the right place to start. But, who would have thought we were carrying around in our pocket what we're carrying around today? I don't know. I mean, personally, I'm not convinced how many more how many more cameras we need on the back of a phone as we miniaturize things even further. Maybe it's time to start thinking about what security we put into this. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that the phone in 10 years' time is going to look somewhat different from a security perspective from what we're carrying around today.
Yeah, if you don't have three cameras or four cameras, right?
You're just not the cool kid.
You're just not the cool kid.
You know,
yeah, because exactly. The Pixel 4 only has two, you know, rear-facing that's cameras. Right, and everyone's right. Like, well, it's not as clearly inferior to the new iPhone because, you know.
It only has three cameras, yeah.
Good yeah, Lord. It kind of feels like, I would hesitate to use the phrase diminishing returns, but, you know mm-hmm. just maybe.
Maybe. Henry, thank you so much for the conversation, and thank you for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
And we'll take a quick break, and then we'll cover the leadership and communications articles for this week.
Cloud adoption is ramping up, but prevention-based security isn't enough for the hybrid attack surface. That's why Gartner predicts that 60% of enterprise security budgets will go towards detection and response in 2020. ExtraHop RevealX Cloud delivers cloud-native network detection and response for the hybrid enterprise, the only SaaS-based NDR solution for AWS. Request a 30-day free trial of RevealX Cloud at extrahop.com/trial. That's extrahop.com/trial. Keep your company and products relevant, competitive, and reliable by standardizing your security framework to protect intellectual property, become a reliable business partner, and guard financial and customer information. Standards Connect is an online standards management solution from ANSI. It's Standards Access Simplified. Standards Connect is a cost-saving, fully customizable solution for entrepreneurs and companies that spend $2,000 or more per year on standards and want to translate spend into a subscription model, want to simplify access, search, monitoring, and collaboration, or need a centralized hub of standards for multiple users at one or more locations. Get a free trial at securityweekly.com/ANSI. That's /ANSI.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Paul Asadorian and Jason Albuquerque. Please help us with our annual listener survey. Use the survey dropdown on the new website and select 2019 listener survey to give us your feedback. We definitely want to hear from our listeners because we want to improve our content and continue to make improvements. So please fill out that survey and help guide us. Also, we have exciting news about the Security Weekly webcast program. We are now partnered with ISC Squared as an official CPE provider. If you attend any of our webcasts, you will receive one CPE credit per webcast. Register for one of our upcoming webcasts with ServiceNow, Great Horn, or Core Security, or all of them, by going to securityweekly.com. Click the webcast dropdown from the new menu and select registration. If you missed any of our previously recorded webcasts, you can find them in our on-demand library by selecting on-demand from that same webcast dropdown. All right, we're going to talk articles, but first, there's a congratulations required first. So Jason, congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
Tell the audience kind of the good news, and then I have some questions for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So recently, my organization brought me in the leadership of the organization and wanted to ask me if I would take a more strategic role within the company. Right. So we're a technology services organization, managed services organization, and I've spent the last 2.5 years really trying to ingrain security best practices into the business and really get maximize the seat at the table. Let's say. Build relationships across every business unit, get in front of our customers as much as we possibly can, and really use security as that competitive advantage within the organization. And, the assumption I'm going to make is that I did a fairly decent job and my team did a great job. And, recently they asked me to take on a new role as CIO while retaining the CSO title. As I was sitting down with the leadership of our CEO, our chief revenue officer, along with our marketing leader and HR leaders, they realized that having that security title was still important. It was a strategic, strategic initiative for so long, and it built a level of trust with our customers that they wanted me to retain that as well. So I'm now the newly minted CIO and CSO of Carousel Industries.
Congrats! Awesome.
Thank you very much.
So, here's my question now.
Yes,
you're in a unique position.
Yeah.
Right, one that has been a little challenging in most organizations. Yes. The CIO role and the CISO role. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the CISO reported to the CIO and there was concerns about availability versus security. Yeah. Sometimes they were peers. Mm-hmm. How do you view this new role, bringing both the operational aspects of the CIO mm-hmm. hat with yeah. the security components of the CISO role?
Sure, sure. I think I have the added benefit of being the CISO that elevated to the CIO, or I don't even want to say elevated, because again, I look at security and IT as peering organizations, right? But I'm looking at it through the lens of baking security into the DNA of everything we do. So my goal now as the CIO is to make sure our IT engineers are always thinking about security as well, right? So now I get to maximize the spread of the wealth, let's say, and really start grooming IT folks to become security focused within our organization. And again, I truly feel like baking it into the DNA of everything we do is extremely important.
But I do feel like it's a balance too.
Sure,
I think operations should be focused on operations mm-hmm. and have the component of security. Yep. And I think you need the yin and the yang, right?
100%.
Then you need security focused more on security, yep. but understanding the operations. So I don't think security roles never go away.
Never.
Just like never. HR, human resources, never goes exactly. away in the other departments, exactly. right? But I think that the relationships that security has with the business and the other teams mm-hmm. is going to continue to evolve. And that's going to differ per industry, per organization. Mm-hmm. When I was talking about, you know, security's role in operations, it reminded me of working in the university space, you know, 15 plus years ago. A lot of universities tried different strategies. Where do you put security? Do you mm-hmm. put it in networking? Do you yeah. put it in systems administration? Is it a separate department of their own? Where do they report to? Where do the higher level, yeah. who are the higher level people and who do they report to, right? And what it came down to was the maturity level of the organization.
That's
in multiple
really key.
Facets,
that's
right?
really that's, key. Honestly.
That's really it. If you're lacking on the operations side, yeah. then security naturally went to the mm-hmm. when where I was at, they needed our help in operations, yeah. just bodies to be able to mm-hmm. Do the technical work, and that's cool. Other organizations, it may be different sub-schools or whatever, they've got that covered, so security can take on a different role.
Yeah, no, and I think we have the luxury of being a technology company, right? Yeah. So that puts us in a different light. You know, we have technology professionals across the entire mm-hmm. Organization, right? And for me, you know, I'm still keeping that line of separation between IT operations, right, and security yeah. operations.
Yeah.
So there's still going to be the yin and the yang, because I have a security leader that reports to me and I have an IT operational leader that reports to me, and along with other business units as well, right, other departments. But having that, still having that peer network there, right,
right,
where I can have my IT operations leader, my AppSec leader, my you know, security leader, we all sit together and we're strategizing together as a team, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really creating that synergy across all of them. And you know, my goal is to create that relationship so we're all learning from each other mm-hmm. and we're all making strategic decisions together as you know, the office of the CIO, let's say, mm-hmm. right? So again, it still has a seat at the table, which is a beautiful thing, right? I don't want to lose that, because that's the legacy we've built so far, is that security had that elevated seat at the table.
Right.
And you know, the ownership of our organization said, you know what, I want to spread that even more. Spread the culture that we've built in security, mm-hmm. Spread that over to IT operations as well. Be able to leverage IT as a competitive advantage, just like we did with, mm-hmm. with the security team. Make it a differentiator. And one of the things that, you know, I'm not sure if I've mentioned on the show, but about a year into my role as CISO, the leadership of the organization said, listen, we want to get you in front of customers as much as we possibly can to have these great conversations, these strategic conversations about technology, the business, and security, all three of those aspects. And they made me one of five executive briefing center facilitators. So we'd bring in our customers from all over the world. We'd bring them to our EBC, to that briefing center, and we'd have strategic conversations with them. I leveraged that opportunity to lead by example, model the way, right? So as a customer, here's what we're doing with our security operations, best practices, technologies, things of that nature. And it would create a conversation of, ooh, we want to follow that, or ooh, we want to, you know, we would love to implement those processes. So now it's taking that same mentality, that same culture, and now spreading it across IT in general and security, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out over the next number of months, because I think it's a great example for others to learn, right, of how these two teams, these two organizations who have traditionally maybe been at odds with each other, how do they really come together in the future organization? Because I think that's going to be an important one for a lot of leaders out there to figure out.
Agreed. Agreed. Yeah, I think it's I think it's a great move for our organization, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, not just speaking selfishly, I think that this shows that there is that pathway to leadership for the security, for security leaders out there. And I think the moral of the story is learn the business. That's what I focused on. Learn the business goals, integrate with those leaders who are making strategic decisions within the organization, and then really fit security into those conversations, security and compliance, get to know your customers, get to know your clients, right? Because that's what's driving the business as well. I mean, if you can have those strategic conversations with your highest level leadership teams and what the customer's needs are, you can truly understand the business as a whole.
Yeah. No, I agree with you 100%. Like I said, we could do all, we don't even need the leadership articles at the rate we're going. We could keep going here. But
I love it.
There are a couple I want to get to.
There. Absolutely.
And the first one ties into this a little bit, which is why I asked some of the questions. It's that balancing the company needs with employee satisfaction, right? And as you think about your new role, this article was interesting to think, and I pulled this in before we were going to talk about this anyways, but you know, how do you balance the needs of the company with employee satisfaction? This article gives you some tips and tricks. I was curious on your thoughts, Jason, on this one, knowing that you need to do a little bit of this balancing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, for one of the lines that was in here that I really focused on and I liked was from individual happiness to collective purpose, right? For me, that was a lot of insight because I'm a people person. I love sitting with my staff, with my employees, getting to know them, building relationships. But what this did was this made me really think about it, to never disenfranchise the middle managers, right? Because if you get too ingrained with some of the folks, right, you may be creating a scenario where you could be disenfranchising them from learning opportunities, right? Because, you know, as a leader, I'm here to help coach, mentor, and I can't be letting that part of it go, right? By getting too ingrained with trying to, you know, manage all the way down the stack. You know, building relationships is one thing, but I have to make sure I'm still focusing on my middle management and coaching them and mentoring them. That was one golden nugget that I pulled out of there that I loved.
Well, it's interesting. We talked about an article, I think it was last week, where there's a manager or leader, you can't be the person that they go to for every answer.
That's
because
it.
Because you're going to have a resource constraint,
that's
right?
It.
You need to enable others in your team and know where to direct people for the answers, not be
that's
the
right.
person who's answering.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah.
That's 100% the purpose of that one right there.
Yeah, and I think it ties into the second point here, which is a move from engagement to ownership, right? You need to enable your managers and your middle managers to take some level of ownership so that they can be successful and start to make those decisions. And so you've got to move that mind shift a little bit and provide some more ownership to the employees and to your managers in the organization.
Yeah, and allowing people to have skin in the game, right? You want to make sure that you're creating a culture where you know, your leaders who report to you can put some skin in the game and then really model that way all the way down, you know, to the entire team. So that's a huge one. I mean, you know, a lot of leaders think by implementing perks and, you know, having dress down Friday and, you know, pizza parties and things of that nature are really going to make all
so
the difference.
You need a sense of purpose in your job.
That's the key.
The main reason I've left most jobs is because that sense of purpose was missing. And look, is an employee or as a manager or as a leader, there has to be purpose to what drives you on a day-to-day basis.
Yep.
If you don't give them the ability to have that purpose, it's really hard to keep those employees happy, and which means they're going to leave.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they need to know the end game, right? They need to know the outcomes that you're driving to as a leader. They also need to know the outcomes that
hopefully the outcome isn't half the universe is wiped out, but just saying.
True indeed. True indeed. But it's not just the purpose of your department. It's also, you know, what's the outcome that the business is looking for, right? So how do they start aligning to business objectives upstream as well? So that's one thing that I love to make sure that I'm transparent with communicating to my leaders, is that, you know, here's the goal of the business, and here's how the goals of our department align to those goals. And these are the objectives that we're going to be marching to for either the year or next couple of years, whatever the case may be. But really giving that level of visibility into why we're doing what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That leads a little bit into a later article, but I want to cover it now, which is four principles for security metrics, right? You talk about goal alignment. Yeah. Then there has to be some measurement around that. And I think one of the areas that a lot of organizations struggle with are, you know, what are the right security metrics, how to measure them, et cetera. And this article, it was an interesting approach to me. I hadn't thought about it this way. I was thinking through some of the examples when I was doing my metrics presentations when I was at Tenable, and I started to apply this approach, and I went, yeah, I can get most of the way there. There was a couple nuances I didn't know how to account for, but I just thought it was interesting, your thoughts when it comes to, you know, developing and measuring security metrics. Mm.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously you have to get deep into the processes that you have, right? Being able to pull those metrics out of the department is all dependent on how mature your processes within that department are. So being able to take some of that, but it also has to be metrics that mean something to the team, right? You can't just be creating metrics in the business, right? So now I'm going up the stack, right? So, I look at metrics in a couple of different ways. Metrics that my team sees to know that they're performing to the expectations. And then metrics that we're going to share upstream to leadership and the rest of the organization. So there's really two different aspects there.
Well,
right?
And because there's a priority, like how much work you put into collecting those metrics and what's the value.
Absolutely.
Right? Sometimes collecting metrics can't necessarily be automated at that time. And if you're inserting in your process extra steps to collect metrics that really don't mean anything to the team or the business, then those are non-value add, right? Yeah, exactly.
So that's what I'm saying. I mean, when, you know, this article says start with the process and start understanding the reality of the processes. Well, you know, the next piece of that is make sure that you're creating the metrics around processes that add value to the conversations. Add value to the conversations when you're having your team meeting, or add value to the conversations that I'm having when I'm meeting with the rest of the leadership. If we're looking for funding or budget or headcount or something like that, we need to make sure we have the right metrics in place. So taking the time to think about which processes you want to focus on within your department and make sure that they add value to the conversations that you're having.
And make sure those metrics make sense too.
Yeah.
Like just like what we're doing with our stats engine, right? Like a lot of it is, you can automate to a certain point where then humans have to look at it and make sure the numbers make sense.
Validate it. Yeah.
What you don't want to do is base any decisions for your team or the business on metrics that there's a mistake somewhere in there, or artificially inflated or deflated for whatever reason.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and I thought what was interesting is understanding the reality of the process to even know if you can measure it. Mm-hmm. The one I had a really interesting challenge around, wrapping my head around, was creating one metric per process.
Yeah,
because there's a couple processes, examples in my head where I'm like, boy, could I really just boil it down to one metric?
Right. Yeah.
That was the one piece that was a little difficult for me to wrap down. And I guess the question is, do I now need to have a sub process to break that down even further to align that? But that was the only concern I had is, you know, for a given process, can you have more than one metric? And I could see a couple examples where you might. So that was the one piece that kind of
forces you to pick your most important metric, right?
See, that's what the important piece is, right? And for me, I looked at that item as that could really take you down the rabbit hole, right? I mean, honestly, you can really start going down the rabbit hole of one metric per process. That might be overkill. And again, it's value add, right? Let's start looking at those high level process buckets. I'm looking at it from like a lean business process management lens right now. And every process kind of has those process buckets that they roll up to. And you have to find the value add processes that you actually want to start focusing on and building metrics around. If it's not going to add value to the conversations, like I mentioned earlier, I don't see any value in focusing on one metric per process that you do within your organization. It's a rabbit hole.
Yeah, that's the one I had a little issue with. The second article, the one I skipped a couple, this was an interesting one. Why successful people wear the same thing every day? My wife hates that I have a bajillion quarter zips. But all I have to do is just grab the one on top, mm-hmm. and I don't have to worry about what I wear.
Yeah.
And I started reading this article, and I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. It's just one less decision in a very finite set of decisions that a leader makes in a day that they don't have to make, and therefore can spend that energy on other more important decisions. I thought this was a really interesting article.
It is, and it's where I want to be when I grow up.
Yeah, right.
I want to be able to get to that point where I have enough operational efficiency in my life that I don't have to worry about what I'm getting up and putting on in the morning and what shoes I have to wear and what tie I'm going to put on if I have an executive briefing center meeting. And yeah, I look at that as 100% operational efficiency in your life.
Yeah, I'm not sure how impactful that is. And I don't know, some people get joy out of making that decision every day as well, which I think there's something to be said.
And that's where I'm at right now. I really do. Like, I like the night before grabbing the clothes I'm going to wear
night
the next day.
Night before is key. Yeah, you know? I agree. Do it the night before so you can wake up in the morning and not have to worry about it and go through the motions.
So that's, I'll say 80% of the time I try to do that, right? I can't do that every day. But that really sets up my morning so that I don't have to worry about what's happening.
Like what you wear and also how you accessorize, I think, is more where my decisions come in. What hat am I going to wear?
It talks to your personality.
Right?
You know, it's part of a personality.
Anyway, we're getting... Accessorizing is important. It can lead to a lot more decisions. Yeah. So,
Alderman is just pulling a quarter zip out of the drawer. It's whichever one's on top. Dang it. Maybe that's laziness instead of success. I don't know.
True.
But
I say it's operational efficiency. And I'm jealous.
Yeah, be a little of both.
All right. So talking about operational efficiency, do you guys use any of these tools to be more productive on your phone? Because I didn't know of any of these.
I didn't either, but there's two of them I really loved, which is the Procreate and the Forest apps. I'm going to try them. I'm literally going to download those tonight and take a peek.
I didn't see those. Oh, I missed that story for some reason. It was buried in there.
Well, the first one, Notability, is, Paul, I think you've done this with some of your tablets where you take notes, it converts it to text. This is an app that runs on your phone
that
you can use with a stylus that converts it to text and email to yourself. And you've used other devices like this.
Yeah.
I'm still a paper guy. I from 2009 on, all my notepads, all my composition notebooks, I know exactly where they are. If I need anything, that's where I go. This is a one big thing with me I have not been able to convert over, and that is my paper note-taking stuff. I just can't do this. But to your point, Procreate, again, I don't do a lot of drawing stuff. I thought Force was an interesting one because it forces you to set up a certain amount of time of not doing certain activities, and I thought that one was actually pretty interesting.
Yeah, no, I love that one. For me, I'm running 1,000 miles an hour all day every day, and to be able to kind of take that and get a little bit of focus around my life, and when I'm running 1,000 miles an hour, it's only going to help me be more productive. So I want to try this. I really want to be able to focus a little bit more and not feel like I'm running 1,000 miles an hour every day. The reason I like the Procreate app, though, is I notice a lot of people, they learn and consume information differently, right? So some people may do really well with bullet points, and some people may really do well with the visual type learning, right? So for me, I'm always trying to get better skills of telling a better story. So I think stories can actually, help folks either learn or consume information. And for this, it gives you the ability to kind of illustrate the story you're trying to tell and put a little bit of visual around it.
I think if you can set goals for yourself, you should evaluate tools that can help you achieve your goals.
Yeah.
But I think better tips are what you do the day before to prepare yourself for the next day, right? And set goals for that next day, right? Like Matt, you and I both know, we look at our calendar and go, not just for today, right? But like, what's tomorrow look like? Based on tomorrow, what are some of the goals that I want to accomplish? And I know based on my schedule, how much time I can spend doing some coding in our app, doing some security research, doing some tasks to support the team, and how well that's going to be balanced. Make those decisions, just like we talked about getting dressed, make those decisions the night before.
Sure.
And just like Patriots and all their teams in the NFL, the most prepared team is usually the team that wins, right?
Absolutely.
Be that team that wins by just being more prepared for the next day. And if there are apps that help you do that, I think we could all conceivably have a set of different apps that we use to 100%. Help you with that in technology based on what, if I'm doing a lot of briefings, sure, I'm going to need something that it digitally transcribes. I might use a different tool than when I'm coding than when I'm doing research, right?
Yep. Yeah, my key is typically on a Sunday, I'll kind of look at my entire week. And set those big lofty goals for the week. Here are all the major things I need to accomplish. And I get up fairly early. I get up around 4:45 every day. And really my first, you know, hour or so is really thinking about, all right, I know I had all these lofty goals. I know this is what's on my calendar for today. That's how it aligned with all those lofty goals. Here are the five things I'm going to bang out today. I'm going to make sure I bang those five things out.
Sometimes that's one. Sometimes that's five. Depends on the day.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Because that one may be a major thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Could be. Like, all my survey result analytics today to prepare for the meeting this afternoon. Yeah, that was my whole morning outside of preparing for my two shows for the day. So, yeah.
Which was good because I got caught up on our show analytics engine and made progress on that, which is good.
Right. The last article I wanted to hit is on the three lessons of the future of talent pipelines. This article gets pretty in-depth into some different topics I didn't really want to talk about, but there were two points that came out of here that I thought were interesting for us to all think about. And the first one is that the digital skills gap may be one of the biggest challenges in the talent pipeline going forward. And, you know, we talk a lot about digital transformation, but this shift away from, you know, more manual mechanical to digital and digital service stuff, this tends to be one of those big gap areas that I think a lot of organizations struggle with finding the right talent to bring into an organization. So that one made a lot of sense to me. The second one, which is the last one, which is employers can expect never-ending reskilling. And again, I think this is one of those big challenges when we move into a digital economy, is that constant change in retooling the skills of your employees. And this is going to continue over time. I think we're going through that process now, but this article is like, look, it doesn't stop. It's going to continue. Just something for organizations to have to realize as they're out hiring.
Yeah, 100%. And we've talked about it on the show before that, you know, I think organizations need to kind of retool their hiring processes as well. Right? You know, the requirements that they have, must have master's degree, must have CISSP, you know, where we may be missing the next greatest whatever you're trying to hire because you're so narrowing your scope because of those requirements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. We'll see you next week on Business Security Weekly.